Particularly if this is your first meeting of this season. So the chief medical officer is also an obstetrician, and I'm the only chief medical officer ever to still see patients. I'm also the first female chief medical officer in Scotland. So I have three children, and my children used to understand what I did for a living, so I went to work to help the ladies who were having their babies. But when I got this new job, my son and I were walking into school together. He was holding my hand and he said, "Mummy, this new job of yours, it's all about keeping people healthy, isn't it?" I said, "Yes, it is, George, it is." He said, "Not going to sound sweet, sorry." I said, "No, George, I'm not. I'm also unlikely to ban wine. Don't say that publicly." So, one of the roles of the chief medical officer is to write an annual report every year. And that annual report is a snapshot of the health of the nation. So a lot of data, a lot of statistics, and of course in Scotland what essentially comes up as is too much alcohol, too much sugar, too much tobacco, and not enough running around. So I did that with all of the data, which is very helpfully presented in the second half of my report. But what I decided to do with the first half of the report was something a little different. So I wrote an open letter to the medical profession in Scotland and asked them if we could practice medicine differently. Because when I was going out and about around the country, I was hearing from my medical colleagues that they were not feeling that the medical profession was being listened to. That they were feeling that their status had been eroded. They were feeling all the pressure of time, pressure of volume of work. And they also felt that they were sometimes being pushed into practicing medicine that wasn't the medicine that had taken them to medical school. So I wrote to them and asked them six questions, and I'll talk to you about those in more detail in a moment. But I have then asked for feedback, because I didn't know whether what I was thinking about medicine would resound at all with other people. But in fact, it has been widely recognised and welcomed by, not only by doctors, but by nurses, by pharmacists, by physiotherapists, by paramedics, and by people not only in Scotland, but all over the world. So the social media that is Twitter, which you may or may not think is a good thing. I like Twitter because I can get the 140 character snapshot of the news before I get out of bed in the morning, and then I have myself psyched up for what the radio is going to be asking me about later that day. So Twitter has shared my realistic medicine reports 5 million times all over the world. And I haven't had a single negative comment. So what I asked the medical profession was that could we practice realistic medicine? So should we be changing the way that we're practicing medicine? Change it to shared decision making? And build a more personalised approach to care. So I'm going to tell you two stories. The first story is about a man in Ayrshire. When you're the chief medical officer, you get invited to visit all sorts of parts of Scotland. And when you visit, lots of people are brought forward to speak to you. So I went to Ayrshire, and this man came forward to be introduced to me. And they told me that he was speaking to me because he had recently had a knee replacement. And I said, "Hello, how's the new knee? Are you pleased with your new knee?" "Not really." I said, "Is it not working? Are you in pain?" "Well, you see, doctor, I didn't really want a new knee." "What was it you wanted?" "I wanted a grab rail." "So you wanted a grab rail?" "Yes, because I like to stand on my doorstep and speak to my neighbour. And my knees were sore, and so a grab rail would help me do that. Now, I still haven't got a grab rail, but what they've given me is a knee replacement. And I still can't stand on my doorstep." So I wonder if, and I'm sure the clinicians who saw that man, the knee no doubt had osteoarthritis, no doubt it was bad enough to have the necessity of a knee replacement, but actually that wasn't what that man asked for, nor did that man get what he was actually prioritising. I'll tell you another story. This is about a man in Lanarkshire. Now this man has an unusual hobby, as you can tell. He also has pigeon fancier's lung, perhaps unsurprisingly. So this has meant that over the years he is regularly admitted to hospital. His lungs deteriorate year on year, as you might expect them to. He has onset of breathlessness, he gets a little bit worse, he comes in and out of hospital. So a phone call came, a friend of mine was on call, Jerry Trishner, currently elderly physician in Lanarkshire, and the call came in that this man was once again breathless and could he be admitted. And Graham has started a new hospital at home in Lanarkshire, where people are unable to stay at home to be looked after. There are virtual wardrobes on Skype, and the nursing staff come in to give them medication every day. And Graham said, maybe this man would be suitable for the hospital at home. So he decided to go out and visit the man. Nobody had ever been in this man's house. So Graham went in, interviewed him. Yes, indeed, he was very breathless, probably needed to be admitted to hospital. And Graham started the conversation with him about the pigeons. You can tell where this conversation would be going. Well, you do realise that your lungs are getting worse because of the pigeons. You do realise that if you got rid of the pigeons, you would stop deteriorating, you wouldn't be admitted to hospital, and you might live longer. And you could see the man's daughter in the corner of the room sort of beckoning him out. So he stopped the conversation about giving up the pigeons, and the daughter said, I think, Doctor, you might like to see my father's back room. And these pictures aren't very clear because this is a tiny little room. And you'll see that those trophies, those pictures are portraits of his pigeons. He has a portrait of every winning pigeon. He then believes actually that they stop winning. Anyway, he is actually, at one time, was the UK's best pigeon racer. And those sheds that you can see in the bottom corner contain 200 to 300 pigeons. And his prize racing pigeon was sold for £30,000. So what did the daughter say to Graham? Doctor, he's not giving up his pigeon. Will you stop asking him to do that? He would rather die than give up his pigeon. He goes to the hospital every 6 months, they give him the lecture about the pigeons, he comes home, he goes back into the sheds. He stays with them, he talks to them, he feeds them, he loves them for 2 or 3 hours every day. He's not getting off the pigeons. So I wonder, when I ask people, what is it that is the priority? We can give medicine to this man, and in fact, Graham kept him at home. He hooked up the IV antibiotics to the standard lamp in the sitting room. He gave him an injection of IV hydrocortisone and left him at home to be looked after there. But do we really talk to people about what their priorities are? Do we really enable people to have that personalised care? So I'm going to let Alistair tell his own story. So Caroline is a renal physician in Edinburgh, and Alistair really needs to tell us his story.
Well, I would say my current medical condition has much improved in the last 3 months. At that point, every part of this year was very unwell indeed. At the moment, I'm much surprised that how much I've improved with part of the treatment I had in the renal department. It was all done, in my opinion, through close consultation other specialists, the GI people, for example, who came for a very good team decision between me and yourself. And I was much delighted at my current situation because I thought I was going to fall off the edge at one point.
What is the news?
We discussed it with the team. And they say, well, the second we can use it, right? Prolong the life to a considerable extent. The other side happens to have a shorter term with quality of life rather than just driving on in the same old drugs and everything else. The side is to come off as walking, you know, for 18 years. Just keep it open, and that was it. and there's also an amiodarone, which a pharmacist can tell is a violent thing. And it's kind of poison. But, so I've come off amiodarone, and I was given another one to control the bumps in my stomach. And since then, I've gone through day by day.
If your condition deteriorated to the point that dialysis might be considered, not a patient with that level of compulsion, what's your understanding about dialysis and what's the relationship supposed to be here?
Well, having been in hospital with lots of people that didn't have any dialysis and so on, we've made a decision, or somebody's made a decision, that that's the right thing for them. And they're doing this, ask me if they want to go on or not. It's asked me if it's going to be. I don't think I know.
Why not?
I don't want to be every second day in here. I've got so many things wrong. And Dallas is just part of the whole thing.
We sometimes talk about shared decision making. Is that something that you recognise that happens in your care?
The condition I am in now, thankfully, is due to making shared decisions between my consultant and doctor. And that is all the difference to me.
Have you ever felt under pressure not to have a particular treatment?
No.
I think our doctors can sometimes find it very hard to be very honest and explicit to patients, particularly when it's around really bad news. How do you feel about that?
It doesn't come easy, but I'm sure it's part of the job. And I don't think it should be done coldly either. You can't just suddenly tell them, don't buy a season ticket for starting off in next season. Benefit of both the clinician and the patient, and some sort of report established. A clinician's doctors have great bedside manner. There are some of the people who still have to learn it. And as an outsider, I don't know how you do it.
So, Alistair is one of Caroline's conservative dialysis clinic patients. The conservative hemodialysis clinic is so conservative that, in fact, you don't get hemodialysis at all when you attend that clinic. So, where did all of this come from? Where did this thinking come from? I think on reflection, it's from several things. I think as an obstetrician, we have in maternity services always had our women, as most of them are not ill, not patients in the same sense as people who are using the NHS for other reasons. And we've always had quite a holistic approach to our pregnant women and their partners, their families, their other children. And of course, we also give women choice in where they are going to have their babies and in what way they're going to have their babies. So I think perhaps my background as an obstetrician can help. The other thing that happened was that I read a lot of research about doctors and the choices that doctors make at the end of life. So at the end of life, 88% of doctors would not have hemodialysis. 95% of doctors would not agree to have CPR to be resuscitated in the event of a cardiac arrest. And 67% of doctors would not be admitted to intensive care at the end of their lives. And that made me think, well, what is it that I know that would make me act differently to what people do for the patients? So, of course, in fact, the patients get all of these things offered to them. And in fact, that's not what the doctors would do for themselves or their own families. A recent study in the New England Journal of Medicine, and this was American, but they took a group of patients and a group of their physicians, and they spoke to the physicians about what they thought was important for their patients. And the physicians all said, well, they want to live longer. So what I'm going to do is do whatever I can do, intervene in whatever way I can, give them drugs and medication to make sure that they live longer, because that's what they want. And then they spoke to the patients. And not a single patient prioritised living longer. The patients all said two things. One, I want to be symptom free. And secondly, I want to spend time with my family. So what is it about the disconnect between what the medical profession and other healthcare professionals are doing that actually isn't necessarily what the people we're looking after are asking us for? And the third thing then that happened was the Montgomery ruling, which is a legal ruling following the delivery of a baby who had severe disabilities in Lanarkshire some 16 years ago. That court case has just come through about 2 years ago. That lady had a big baby, she had diabetes, and during delivery the baby got stuck. There was a degree of shoulder dysplasia, and the baby ended up with the difficulties, lifelong disabilities, very significant. So when this case came to court, what happened was that the case was presented about the risks of a cesarean section electively for that lady versus her having a normal delivery. And she said that if she had been counseled about the risks of anything happening as did happen with her son, she would of course have opted for an elective cesarean section. Because any tiny risk, no matter how small, was not going to be worth taking for the outcome that she ended up with. And the court ruled in her favour. So previously in the UK, what we had was that practice had to be what any reasonable doctor felt were the risks that needed to be explained. And any reasonable doctor practicing in a way that was similar to the case going through court. But we now have the Montgomery ruling, and what the Montgomery ruling would say to us is, it's what the patient thinks are the risks that we need to be consenting for. Not the doctor, but when the patient has the procedure explained to them, where would it be that they would place the risk? So we have a UK legal precedent which actually can now be applied retrospectively to cases that are coming through the courts. So I suppose what I think is that this puts the patient at the centre of what we're doing. I have three children, so I have to tell three children related stories. So this new job of mine takes me all over the place. I've been to Hampden on the football pitch to have my photo taken. I've been to Barcelona, as Colin said. So we're driving to school one day, and my middle daughter Anna says, "Mummy, what weird things are you doing today?" Well, I'm not a conscience to speak about outpatients. There are far too many outpatient appointments, far too many outpatients coming to be seen, and we need to do something about it. By the way, there are 4.7 million outpatient appointments in Scotland every year. There are only 5.2 million people, 3 million everybody wants, and it's not. So she said, this outpatient issue is a big issue, we need to do something about it. And she said, "Mummy, what's an outpatient?" I said, "Well, it's a patient that isn't in the hospital." She said, "Yes." I said, well, they come to the hospital or to the clinic and we see them and then they go away again. And she said, "Well, where do they go?" Well, they go home, or back to work, or back to school, or back to whatever they were doing. And she said, "Isn't that a person, Mum?" So I wonder whether the people formerly known as patients get embroiled in our healthcare system, and we sometimes maybe forget, like our Christian family and gentlemen, that they actually have other lives and have other things to do, and that our bit of their life is not necessarily the most important or as important to them as we think it might be. So, in asking that question, I came also to talking about reducing harm and waste. And what I talk about is that waste is traditionally understood as a very wasteful system. People think about waste as being things that are thrown away. But I would actually talk about waste as being when something is done that doesn't add value. But that is in fact wasteful. If it isn't adding value to the person that we're treating, then that is a waste of resource, a waste of medicine, a waste of money. And I talk also about unnecessary variation in practice and unnecessary variation in outcomes. So if I tell you that I see a lot of data I go to a lot of conferences and I sit through a lot of audits. So in my own practice of obstetrics and gynaecology, if I told you that the hysterectomy rate across the UK varies by a factor of fivefold, and the induction of labour rate in Scotland is 32% in one hospital and 18% in another hospital. And I'm not prepared to blame the mothers, the babies, or the wounds for those differences in practice. And I looked at many other specialties. So if we take hip fracture, the commonest fracture in numbers, and very debilitating, we know that the outcome is better if you have your hip fracture repaired with a hip replacement within 36 hours. When we look at like, the total time that people are in hospital after a hip fracture, that varies across Scotland from a median of 13 days in one unit to a median of 23 days in another unit. And in one unit in Scotland, 63% of people get back home after their hip fracture, and in another unit in Scotland, 95% of people get back home after their hip fracture. And I'm not prepared to blame the hips or the elderly people for those variables either. When I look at urology, the rate of cystoscopy, so minor bladder symptoms need a bit of a look in the bladder. The rate of cystoscopy varies across Scotland by a factor of fourfold. Another fold. So everywhere I go, I look at these data and I ask questions. I don't know what the right rate of hysterectomy is. The right rate of induction of labour is. But I don't talk to the orthopaedic surgeons about how long people should stay in hospital. So I ask the questions, and in fact people are often very surprised by these differences in data, these differences in how the best units are performing in a small country compared to others. So I think we need to reduce this unwarranted variation in practice, because what it leads to is unwarranted differences in outcomes. People do less well if their hip is not repaired in 36 hours or less. So I talk also about managing risk. Managing risk, of course, in our Scottish world leading Scottish patient safety programme has made huge differences to hospital mortality rates, to our infection rates in hospitals, big falls in these, which were major issues. And Colin kindly talked about the work that I've done in reducing stillbirths across Scotland. Our stillbirth rate has been static for 20 years in Scotland. Our stillbirth rate has fallen by 18% in the last 4 years since we looked at stillbirths, the causes of stillbirths, and decided not to accept that stillbirths just happened because they just happened, and actually did something about it. And so there were 100 families who took a baby home last year, 100 more families who took a baby home last year than had taken a baby home the year before. So we managed to prevent those 100 stillbirths. So that's very important. But managing risk, of course, is very sophisticated. And the senior decision maker who takes the riskiest decisions is often the medical professional. Other professionals also do, but the doctor is often the one who is taking those difficult decisions. But do we realise that when people are under stress, when they're overworked, and the volume of work is greater, then it is that decision making about risk that disappears first? So people become very risk averse when they are stressed. So I wonder whether we actually support our health service colleagues, our nurses, doctors, physios, pharmacists, paramedics, because actually what they will become is risk averse. They'll make poorer decisions, and that will affect outcomes. Can we manage risk better by supporting our staff better? So I also talk about becoming improvers and innovators. And I think that people think that innovators need to be inventing a machine or a cure for something. But in fact, what I have seen is innovation everywhere I've been to. So I've been to some of the wards where the most junior doctors were telling me about their quality improvement and practices. So doing very junior doctors, one of their tasks, any of you have been junior doctors, one of the tasks is, of course, to take the blood. there are phlebotomists to help, but the doctor always ends up with the most difficult cases to get dealt with. So what the junior doctors realised was that there were always a lot of blood tests left over at the end of the day that hadn't been taken. What they also realised was that this was actually delaying discharge for some of these people because the results they expected, but the consultant result wasn't ready, and in fact the blood hadn't actually left the patient's arm. So what they did was they filmed on their iPhones, they filmed all of the steps it is from someone asking for a blood test to that blood test getting the result in the patient's nose. And they realised that during that process there were 8 redundant steps, either repeated or not needed at all. So they chopped out the 8 redundant steps, they spoke to their phlebotomy colleagues, they got a system, much more efficient, and they actually reduced the length of stay on that hospital board. The most junior cost nothing. And yet those people were the right people to be changing their own system, because they, as the junior doctors, are the ones that knew where the changes could be made. But I also talked then about bigger improvements, bigger innovations. And what I asked about is whether, in fact, we are actually implementing the practice in medicine that we already know works well. So you'll be familiar perhaps with the need, the guidance to give people aspirin if they've had a cardiovascular event, a stroke or a heart attack. You get aspirin and that will prevent to some extent a second event. And most people are eligible to have aspirin. In Scotland, how many people who are eligible for aspirin get aspirin, I wonder? Stroke, might get another one. Let's give you something that costs £1.50 to prevent another stroke. Pretty simple? Well, only 57% of people who are eligible for aspirin actually get it. What do we do about that problem? Well, what we did was, we thought, I don't know, let's do a lot of work in the lab and come up with another drug that's much more effective. It's called clopidogrel, and it is more effective. But it would need to be 90% more effective to have the same effect as giving the other 42% of people aspirin who are actually eligible for aspirin. The drug costs 10 times as much, and I'm afraid it's only 10% more effective than aspirin. So I talk in my report about translating what we know in research into actual practice on the ground. And I talk about the importance of research being actually relevant to the NHS, and the importance of research into treatment or medication that's actually going to be used by the NHS. Perhaps maybe moving away from research for research's sake. And actually moving into something where public money is being spent to improve our outcomes. So maybe we need some research into why everybody doesn't get aspirin. Not inventing another drug that's a bigger, better aspirin. So I talk about that, and I talk to academic audiences about that. They don't necessarily feel that I'm necessarily the most popular person in the room when I challenge them like that, but I think it's important to ask the questions. This, after all, is public money. So, you'll see on my slide that the infographic has been shared all over the world, and what people have then said is we're not sure that we really like this realistic medicine, it's a bit Medicaid. And I said, well I'm a doctor, and I'm a chief medical officer, and I wrote to the doctors, so that was where this came from. But actually, a lot of different groups would like to have their own version of realistic medicine. The pharmacists are going to call realistic medicine. And they also suggested that it should be realistic healthcare, or in fact, perhaps realistic health and social care. And I have no problem with that, because I think what this has become is a way of talking about practicing medicine. And whether that's medicine or healthcare or health and social care, I don't know. So this is the Twitter stuff, in case you didn't believe me, and that's the binary nothing. Some of you may or may not know Sir Muir Grey. He is really one of the founding fathers of public health. He invented screening as we know it, and his comment was, Catherine Coldwood, I was understated in my praise. It's one of the best documents I have read in 44 years. And he's read a lot of government documents. So, where do we go? What do we do? Where do we go next with this? So, these are some of the comments that I thought the Philosophical Society would like to see. And I was very pleased actually to be coming back to Rotten Row. I haven't been in Rotten Row since I was a medical student in Glasgow learning my obstetrics in the maternity unit, so far better. So is this just illusory? I told you some nice anecdotal stories, and then pack up those with some jolly lively stories about my own children. So perhaps this is just emotional. Someone has said it's enlightened. Is this a new way of thinking? And our medical schools around the country have said that they will put realistic medicine on their syllabus within the curriculum. It seems to have a global application. My Barcelona conference has now got spread to Quebec City and an invite to Salzburg in Austria in December. Does it maybe bring back the art of medicine? A little bit more art with science. And I wonder, does it play to the very well-known Scottish intellectual and philosophical wisdom? And maybe that's why it's been well-received at the time. What I have done, though, is really try to make sure that it is joining up with the vision of the Scottish Government. May or may not have time to read the National Clinical Strategy for Scotland, but you will find within it a chapter on realistic medicine. And what I'm saying to my ministerial colleagues, my government policy colleagues is that I think that some of these difficult decisions that have to be made about healthcare can perhaps be made better if we're practicing the various aspects of realistic medicine and bringing the patients or the people along with us on that journey. And so far, I haven't had any dissent. So I would propose to you that perhaps this is a new Hippocratic philosophy. This puts my doctor colleagues back in their positions of leadership. It is absolutely about the multidisciplinary team. Absolutely must be. I couldn't do my job as an obstetrician without the midwives. Couldn't do my job as an obstetrician without the healthcare worker, nor the theatre assistant, nor the person who cleans the theatre after the cesarean section. So I am absolutely solely on the multidisciplinary team. But the multidisciplinary team needs leadership. And the leadership often falls in the hands of the doctor, who are the most senior member of the team. So I wonder if we can also be creative. Certainly it's about empathy, always has been. But perhaps the medics, the doctors, the healthcare professional, whoever that may be, is more of a facilitator, more of a collaborator. And they definitely need to be a communicator. Big study in the 1970s interviewed medical students when they started. They start medical school very, very, very person focused. And they leave it disease focused. But it's perhaps that person at the centre of the care that we should be talking to. So I'm going to a close now. This was a cartoon that somebody sent to me. You'll be very familiar with the Scottish Intercollegiate Guideline Network, the signing guidelines. And Boyd Peters, who's a medical director in the NHS Highlands, he's a psychiatrist. He's written a drawing of my business manager, Mark, standing at my door. There's some wise guy doctor on the phone asking for the signed guideline for realistic medicine. Which has made me think. And once I step back and track down John Kinsella, who's the chair of the sign committee, I perhaps will put it to him that maybe we do need a guideline for realistic medicine. So I hope it's meant something to this audience. I'm very grateful, as I say, for the invitation. And I know we've got plenty of time for questions and answers. I leave you with my contact details. So email me, tweet, look at the blog, because I hope that realistic medicine really takes off and goes somewhere. But it won't do it without support and without feedback and comments. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sullivan. Now, we now have opportunity for those of you who are eager to quickly do so before we have our question and answer session. Now, there are two roving mics, and I have three charming assistants who will assist us with could I ask that you wait for the microphone to come before you ask your questions and hold the microphone horizontally in front of you? And Beth, if you'd like to keep your, give your name before asking a question, and keep the question short.
Yes, Patrick.
Hello, my name is Richard Lee. I'd like to make a comment about what you said. Western medicine has got a lot of strengths, but also has weaknesses. They tend to be a bit too materialistic because they regard people as patients. Well, that's actually not too bad, but it's a bit inflexible because people are much more complicated than patients. People are better than that, well, better than their patients, better than other aspects of their lives. I also need to be aware of this, the bigger picture, not just simply treat the patients, but treat the bigger picture. I'm not saying the doctors are wrong, I'm just saying that they're a bit rigid in their thinking. That's all. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I think you're absolutely right. Absolutely right. That is part of what this conversation needs to be. And what exactly how sophisticated and complicated patients are. So thank you very much for your comments. I think you're talking realistic medicine to me.
Yeah, I'd just like to add to that. My name is Tony McCready. There's another professor on the other side of Glasgow. She talks on about precision medicine. You're talking about realistic medicine. I agree with the guy on the left. It's Western medicine. It doesn't touch on the spirit. And we're all spiritual beings. When it comes to the end, you know, we're talking about Christmas. We're talking about the celebration of Christmas. There's a spiritual side to it.
So thank you, yes, and I know Anna Dimitrik very well, and precision medicine is actually interestingly probably a development of Western medicine that will enable medicine to be very personalised. So for example, our friend Alistair with his warfarin, there will eventually be a way of knowing how much warfarin to dose exactly a person needs through Anna's precision medicine. Not yet, in some time. So in fact, some of precision medicine is realistic medicine because it's going to stop overdosing some people with medication and underdosing others. Your comment, though, of course, is about spiritual beings. You saw that on one of the comments that's been made is about enlightenment, about this being an enlightened way to talk to people. I think that a lot of the conference in Salzburg that I've been invited to contribute to is all about the end of life. And I think that many of these issues are what my colleagues who are palliative care physicians and palliative care nurses are talking about. So I talked to one consultant who said he had really started on this realistic medicine journey because of what he described as a bad death. So a death of a patient of his, which did not occur in the way that person would have expressed or their family didn't feel that she would have wanted the death occurred. So in fact what he has done is started a lot of anticipatory care, discussions with people, not right in the middle of life, but in fact leading up to them and taking into account some of their own feelings about spirituality and their own beliefs and belief system into that.
During your talk, you were mentioning that there are many inefficiencies you encountered. Do you see the current role of technology in the system as benefiting, reducing these inefficiencies, and how do you see technology's role in the future in addressing realistic medicine?
Thank you. That's been an issue that people have fed back to me a lot, is about e-health, telehealth. Undoubtedly, we don't use it as well as we should or could. Scotland's a country with wide expanses of geography that telehealth should be made for, but I would say telehealth, telemedicine also applies in Glasgow. If you don't need to physically be seen, then probably you can do these things by Skype or another method. So I think technology will really help us. The ability, though, and some of the infrastructure around doing that is one of our challenges. The younger generation are already voting with their feet, as it were, with apps and some of these wristwatches, although you have seen the research just last week that shows that people with Fitbits in this one particular group actually put on more weight than the people with other groups. The theory of that being that they had walked their 20,000 steps, so they thought they better treat themselves with some chocolate. So not that technologies are proving to be what you might hope for, but absolutely with you, we need to do things smarter and quicker and join the internet generation much more.
Good evening, Dr. Caller. Going back to the Fitbit, my wife has wear one, and since she's been wearing it, she's put on 5 pounds. But my question is, what is your view? Slightly different question. On so-called complementary medicine, for example, homeopathy. Is that got a place? I'm rather skeptical myself.
So that would be another talk, which would take us till I think where the evidence presents itself, that homeopathy and alternative medicines can be extremely helpful, but the centre in Glasgow here, some controversy about it kills me, it doesn't kill me at all, I don't know where that's come from, but where evidence-based, as I knew right exactly to say, then exactly has it.
Thank you, Dr. Calderwood. My name is Gail Addison. I'm still working as a doctor. Over 40 years, I've seen sort of sedimentary layers building up of guidelines, protocols, and a lot of things that make me feel, as still practicing, quite restricted in what I can do. I liked your story about the GHOs, as I still like to call them, innovating. And I feel I'm less able to innovate than I used to be able to do maybe 20 years ago. And I wonder if you've ever had any feedback from doctors saying, yes, we'd like to innovate, but we're not allowed to do this because of this protocol or that.
So I think in the full report I talk about this restriction of that guidelines basis, and in fact NICE has just 2 weeks ago brought out a guideline for people with multi-morbid conditions, because it's very much felt that there are lots of people with lots of conditions, and do you then have to give them a hypertension guideline, a diabetes guideline, etc. And in fact what that person is benefiting from is not necessarily having guideline-based medicine. So I definitely discuss that. I deconstruct that sort of very rigid way of practicing. I don't know whether that brings us back a little bit more to the art of medicine. It definitely plays to personalised medicine, the person in front of you rather than the series of diseases. So I've definitely heard it a lot. I've been written to by GPs, emergency medicine doctors, all sorts of specialists from all over the country, and that's one of the comments they make, that they find this alternative way of looking at things very refreshing.
Good evening, Dr. Calderwood. My name is Bob Gribben. Maybe a more mundane question. Sorry, maybe a more mundane question. Is there any level of illness, for want of a better way of putting it, at which it needs to be, realistic medicine needs to be considered? The examples you gave were of people who were fairly seriously ill, possibly in one instance approaching terminal illness. Is it at that sort of level where you're considering this should be introduced, or is it even the person who's going in for their annual flu injection or whatever? When do you think it's most appropriate and best managed to introduce this sort of thing?
So So I suppose I don't know the answer, but I'll give you some of the feedback that I've got. So I was recognised on the train by a young surgeon, a trainee surgeon. I have my pictures on the report, so it's one of the disadvantages, I suppose. And he came up to me and he said, I loved your realistic medicine report. I have started talking to people about it, about consenting for operations in a different way. He said, I go through all of the options with them, and then I say to them, you do realize you don't have to do anything at all. Just because I'm a surgeon doesn't mean I have to operate on you. And NHS Borders has made a laminated sheet for the corner of every outpatient clinic room, and it encourages people to ask the question of whoever they're speaking to say, so what are the risks of this? What are the possible benefits? And what might the side effects be? But importantly also, what would happen if I did nothing? So I don't think this is about the end of life or the serious illness. This is about all aspects. And in fact, you can read further about social prescribing, that actually exercise perhaps better for all sorts of things than just your blood pressure. But exercise and losing a little bit of weight will do wonders for you compared to a hypertension pill. The statistic about loneliness is that being lonely is probably as bad for you as smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
Hello, Dr. Ronald Singleton. Tell me, where does the theory of realistic medicine, how does it deal with the question of elective death, assisted suicide, choosing to die?
So it's very difficult for me to comment on that because I work for the Scottish Government and we have a policy position on it at the moment, so I'm not going to answer your question. Perhaps you and I could have a private conversation about that.
Hi there. My name is Renee. I recently completed an MSc in medical anthropology and my course is very focused on this kind of patient-centered care. So I was wondering, since medicine is so evidence-based and empirical, how are you able to measure this realistic medicine actually has a positive outcome on patient care and also on the maybe the curing itself? Are you launching research groups and that?
So thank you. That's a very important question. And of course, I suppose if I'm absolutely honest, I didn't get to this space of needing to implement and measure, etc. Because what I did was wrote a report. I didn't even know that anybody would read it. So having read the chief medical officer's report myself, but only probably about a week before my own interview, I was pretty aware that it wasn't always a document that was seized hold of and run with. So I think we're working on that. Very important to me is to measure what we're doing. I've spoken to the International Collaboration of Healthcare Outcome Measures, IHOM, very big organisation with experts in measurement, so speaking to them about, I mean, how do we measure this? I suppose I think we'll probably start maybe with patient-reported outcome measures, because if somebody feels that they've had realistic medicine practiced, perhaps that's where to start. I don't think this is easy. I don't think that we're going to be able to measure X and get a particularly good, hard measurement, which is what we normally like. But I suppose what I would also say is we also need to move away from, for example, cancer survival. 5-year survival, what does that mean? 5-year survival with what? Is it good quality survival, perhaps, or what's important to the patient's survival rather than a period of time? So I would quite like perhaps to change some of the measures that we're already looking at as towards a much more personal and important to that person-focused measurement. I'd be very grateful for help and advice if you've got some.
Good evening, Dr. Calderwood, David Creed here. My colleague referred earlier to sedimentary layers of guidelines and protocols. Those are generally a product of litigation and the fear of litigation. Don't you feel that realistic medicine will reduce the levels of litigation by making patients more included in their decision making and therefore less likely to complain, sue, and all the other negative aspects that lead to that kind of thinking. Is there any evidence that this might be the case already?
So thank you very much. I'm very glad you've asked that question. It's been a question that has been brought up. In fact, you're more enlightened than lots of my questioners, because they normally say we wouldn't want to practice this because of litigation. And we're afraid that we would be seen as negligent. And actually, having had discussions with both the GMC and the medical defence unions, nothing could be further from the truth. Your point is exactly right, that in fact, if we are talking to patients about what they are wanting, directly recording that, making quite clear that a conversation went forward, then in fact there's no issue with consent or with a doctor acting negligently because they're talking about alternative treatments. Evidence I can give you so far is that One Health Board tells me that their number of complaints for over-intervention has started to overtake any kind of "you didn't do enough" from my relative. I mean, that's One Health Board in Scotland, that's anecdotal, but people are now beginning to write and say that wasn't what we wanted, that was over-treatment.
Dr. Calderwood, good evening. My name's David Lewin. Thank you very much. A lot of what you've talked about involves people changing the way they work, the way they operate, different going forward to what perhaps has been in the past. In the health service, how are medical professionals who not necessarily have been taught how to manage change supported to drive through best practice? How are they helped? How are they supported to do this, given that their medical training really probably doesn't give them any insight into how to do this at all?
So thank you again, back to one of our previous questioners. We're really starting this journey. As I say, I didn't know that I was going to need to be here. I think hopefully the positive feedback means that we're beginning to have a sense that people are wanting to practice medicine like this. What I'm delighted about, though, is that within the Scottish Government Health Department, we have some money set aside to have our policy civil servants who will have realistic medicine in their job title. So we are going to have a part of the Scottish Government Health Department which is implementing realistic medicine. I know that in at least three of the health boards there are doctors with realistic medicine in their job titles. So there is a feeling that this, you're absolutely right, this needs to be supported. We can't just throw it out there and say, oh, it's been seen on Twitter a lot, let's just leave it at that. So in fact, much to my delight, certainly my surprise, we've decided that this is really something worth investing in. Perhaps a country of 5.2 million people, maybe we can, is it small enough that this sort of movement or way of talking could filter through? A friend of mine, my friends often tell me, they've seen me on the news, they usually tell me they'd like my necklace or my jacket, they never really like what I said. But one of my friends was walking along her dermatology ward and she heard one of the juniors turn to the other one and say, well, that was realistic medicine, and she walked past. So I'm not unrealistic that this is an overnight issue. I think communication is very, very important. I've been very encouraged though by the medical students, so at least the next generation, this is going to be part of their learning.
Dr. Calderwood, may I ask you if folic acid is being used in obstetrics now? I'm worried about the observation of breast cancer having a connection.
So we've done a lot of research into folic acid and what harms that too much of it can do. I believe that those concerns about breast cancer, about bowel cancer as well, have all now been put to bed. So I don't think that we have any worries about adverse effects of folic acid anymore. Studies that we've been waiting for, which were only fully published at the beginning of this year, but that the folic acid seems not to have these adverse effects that we don't worry about. But yes, it is being used in effect, but not enough.
I think that it certainly is a very enlightened programme, and thank you for that. I was wondering the extent to which it has been tried, and if so, how much it works with mentally ill patients and in the field of psychiatry.
So I should have acknowledged that. We have Scottish Clinical Leadership Fellows who are doctors in their training that come and work in different parts of the system. So last year I had Christine Gregson, who's an infectious diseases trainee, and she was very much the editor-in-chief of my report. There were then these bright young trainees in colleges, in healthcare, in Scotland, etc. But just on your point, my new clinical leadership fellow is a forensic psychiatrist. So she has already been telling me, I have lots and lots of stories I've gathered up, but she talks about the antidepressant story and about talking to her patients about actually some of these side effects of the drugs that they might be put on, that some people then say, well, actually, I'll stick with my depression. And maybe rather not have those side effects, now that you've talked me through that. Other people, of course, won't choose. So I think it applies, absolutely. And I'm very pleased that she is now going to be taking forward the medicine too.
My name's Jeffrey Jay. Where is the epidemic of destructive obesity leading us? Is there a solution?
That really is a different topic.
Well, some realistic comments might be helpful.
So moving away from the whole, it's just somebody who has no willpower and just eats all the time, that would be a good start. Blaming the person. Mm-hmm. Thinking they're weak willed, they just can't walk past the chocolate webs all so often. People we all can. Where I would start. Secondly, the two things that sort of drive what people eat: price and availability. So you talk to me about our high streets, you talk to me about our supermarkets, mm-hmm. You talk to me about our buy one, get one free offers. And then you talk to me about how much industry has influence over government.
Hello, I'm Karen Bevan.
Hello.
You mentioned the wider social care and health and social care. What scope is there for creating realistic health and social care? Who do you need to engage with, and how can that make it happen?
So I thought I might start with a bit I know, so that's why the health bit is that's where I am, I suppose. I think what's really interesting is that this has then been something that people are wanting to do. I would need help. I think we've got to start what I don't want is to be paralysed by trying to solve it all. So you end up unable to do anything because you've got to do a whole system. I think it lends itself very, very well to social care. There's a whole lot done to people that mightn't be their choice, mightn't be their priorities. So I have lots of allies, I'm going to get more and more allies. And I think we need to just start conversations in other parts of the system. My report was only published at the end of January, so again, we're on a journey, but I'm not hearing that other parts of the system are wouldn't want to come along through that. Just help once again. As well.
Hello, Jeremy Snowden is my name. Two comments. First of all, it's a question for us for common sense. And secondly, 100 babies that wouldn't be alive, the moms and dads?
Brill.
Okay, my GP's practice is extremely under pressure all the time. It sounds like you're going to be consulting what the problem is, and then we have this friendly chat, which seems to me going to be double the time they take. They can't even get locals to come up when they go on holiday. So it sounds like you're going to have to come up with considerably about more money to have at least one more qualified GP who's going to be older usually, if he's going to be able to do this no matter how much training. Age brings understanding. It's hard to be that empathic if you can't be in somebody else's shoes, and that takes time. Older, more experienced chief, who's going to pay for that? This is this custom being brought into
I think we're probably talking about different philosophies where we can then clean up the GP's time for the sort of issues that needs a doctor. So my pharmacist colleagues, very, very keen, highly trained, highly skilled, highly knowledgeable, completely underused. So some of the stories I could tell you about medicines that people are on for years and years and years, and nobody has sat down and looked at that and also looked at the side effects. So I think what we need to start to do is to use our highly skilled running practitioners. The Charter of Society of Physiotherapy came to see me. Their data, I won't get the figures right, so I won't say the percentages, but they tell me that when they are seeing a patient with shoulder problems, they're referring them up for a scan. The GP sees somebody with shoulder problems, refers them up for a scan. One in 10 of the GP referrals are appropriate and end up with something that shows up, and it's something like 8 out of 10 when the physio is there. So the GP, not necessarily the expert in everything, and musculoskeletal probably is a big area where we need to be using other expert practitioners who actually will, by taking some of that work away, will arguably be more appropriate for the patient, the person, and free up the GP, the experienced GP, to do the work that they need to do.
My name is Hazel Johnson, and I'm asking this question from a patient perspective, an interested patient perspective. What's changed for me in the last 10 years, and I know for a lot of my friends and my acquaintances, is the use of the internet. And I wonder how much you think patients and doctors of the internet affect the realistic medicine that you're trying to promote.
So I would say that information is key. We would like the right information to get there. That's one of the problems that we've been instructed. It's not always accurate, the information that's given. A friend of mine gave a mug at Christmas. The mug says on it, "Please do not confuse your Google search with my medical degree." I think that people who have some information, any information, that empowers you, even if you're then able to explain that, well, actually, that only applies to at least that group of people over there. Communication information. In NHS England, there's a patient director on the board of one of their trusts, so he has the same status as all the other directors on the board. And what he has brought in, it's so simple. We send out an outpatient appointment letter, don't we? It has a date and a time on it. Nothing else. What they do is send out for a particular clinic you're coming to see because you've been referred with symptoms of blah, you might like to ask the following questions.
Oh.
And you can apply that, and it's not going to work for everyone, is it? But certainly for some very clearly defined symptoms. So that's going to save our experienced GP's time. And our experience also many people are coming with their thought processes lined up and their questions at the ready.
My name is Jane Pinkerton. I'm one of these GPs that
because it doesn't know as much as I might about musculoskeletal medicine, but really my point is, I think this is great news for all of us working in the medical profession. I think it's probably what we kind of feel in our hearts, but find it difficult to practice. But I'm also wondering if combining it with realistic medicine with realistic expectation would be really helpful. And I mean, I don't mean that in any sort of derogatory way, but more just in terms of what public health could help us with in terms of managing expectation, which might have a bit of an impact on how much our services are being used.
So there have been many comments actually about realistic medicine, and the medical profession, I should say, have said just what you've said, in fact, that this has given them permission to do what they've actually been doing all the time. A GP from Bangalore wrote to me and said, "Dear Dr. Colbert, I've been practicing medicine for 38 years. It's just that I've been doing it under the radar in my own office, and I didn't know that I could come out and say that I was practicing realistic medicine." So I don't think I've invented anything new. What I seem to have done is given permission for people to talk like this. So what somebody tweeted actually was, realistic medicine, what about realistic politicians? and which is not funny if you are in the job that I am in. And what about the public, if you like. So in fact what I've done is the alliance with a group of it brings together the all the patient support charities in Scotland. So they've got everybody from the British Heart Foundation to Alzheimer's Scotland to much, much smaller charities. So that group is going to go out with realistic medicine conversations with those groups of patients. They are there, of course, patients, about like people with illnesses by definition, and also chronic illness, by definition, actually very well. So we're going to talk to those groups about what realistic medicine means for them. And the other, the Scottish Health Council then is organising, starting in November, 14 engagement events from all over the different health boards of Scotland to engage with whoever wants to come. You can have an illness or not, you can be using the NHS or not. And we're just bringing those questions as that way. So what does this mean for people? And this is an audience who's invited me to speak to them. You're all here because you're interested, I assume. I didn't pay anybody, so. But what about that wider members of the public? So that's going to be very interesting, I think, because I may get a shock if it comes back and says, "Those don't need to get it, they're not interested in talking to you like this." But what we are doing is going out and asking.
I wanted to question your use of the term art. I wanted to question your use of the term art when talking about doctors practicing medicine, because it does kind of lead towards then the idea that they're doing art on the patient, and with the kind of connotation that artist has, at least in the current age, artists usually are doing self-expression that most people don't get, and maybe not necessarily won't like. So I really want to ask, what exactly you mean by when you say they could practice their art more? Because would it be more than giving self-expression to the knowledge they have, or just being able to practice their profession as they know from experience sees fit for that particular person?
So that list was, those aren't my terms, but this is what people are commenting to me, is this more art than science? I think that some of you are very deep thinking about art and what art means is really not what they are talking about, meaning people practicing art, it does make you think a little bit of the dark arts as well. But I think that what it's getting at is that the person in front of you and the science are not black and white. I cannot get the politicians to understand that. And that there isn't necessarily a right answer, a wrong answer. That in fact, the way you can interpret research studies, lots of different ways. I would throw in that research studies are done on a selected group of patients. And if you don't fit the criteria, you are not in the study. And then we study a group of people who haven't got multi-morbidity, who are mobile and able to get to the researcher's question place, and then we apply all the stuff that the research turns out to normal people, with all the parts of the people that we were excluded from the study. So there is a bit of art to mention. I suppose what I'm trying to do is to help people understand that a little bit better, to make that more sound.
Hello, it's Richard
Aitken.
Hello, it's Richard Aitken. I'm a logical, critical, evaluative, introspective writer in principle, in practice I'm a research assistant. I want to talk about integrative medicine. Integrative medicine is a combination of mainstream medicine and other types of medicine that are alternative medicine. In America, the practice that, and also in China, was not in China, but acupuncture combined with mainstream medicine. It's much more effective than just mainstream medicine alone, and much more effective than just acupuncture alone.
So
it's combined with medicine in principle grows. If the UK develop integrated medicine, it will prove treatment of patients much more better, much more efficient than even currently right now.
Thank you. And the question is?
Richard Lee. This is not what you're asking. Yes.
Thank you.
Question. Yeah, he was making a comment.
I'm Tiffany Young. You mentioned the engagement with our sex workers. Sorry, can you hear me? You mentioned the engagement with our sex workers. How do you see that being able to relieve the time that takes PTs to actually deal with patients, or the initiative like the Links Worker Program? Do you see that as having a positive impact on realistic medicine?
And thank you very much for your question. I'm a great supporter of the Links Worker Program. For those of you in the audience who don't know about it, there are 40 Links Workers employed in GP practices across Scotland. They're in the deep end practices that runs in the most deprived parts of Scotland. So far, so a start. If I give you an illustration of a GP friend of mine who saw a girl with his surgery. So she, through an administrative error, two children, no work, have had her benefits stopped. He saw her after a fortnight, so she had had no income for a fortnight. She has her children farmed out to various friends to get them fed in the evenings, and she was absolutely at the end of her tether. So she came to him, maybe not surprisingly, was expressing suicidal thoughts. I don't know what I'm going to do. I have no money. I have no way of getting money. My children are hungry, and I can see no way out of this. Now, in the traditional system, what happens there is that you press the psychiatric crisis button. So she would have gone to be assessed in a psychiatric unit. That was an inpatient unit. She would have had her children put into foster care, and then she would have gone down what quite possibly might have been a very medicalised route. What that GP practice has is a links worker. What the links worker did was took the girl, interviewed her, talked to her, got her a £200 emergency lump of cash, took her to a food bank where she filled up with all of her stuff that she needed for her children, and then helped her articulate what the issue was with the benefits being stopped, got the benefits restarted, nobody got any medicine at all, and I would argue nobody needed any medicine at all. But that links worker had the skills and the contacts in order to make that happen. So I think that we're going to roll out more of those. The pilot of 40 has been a great success. And so, and again, you're quite right, that's realistic medicine, it's all realistic not medicine.
Hello, my name is John Scowen. I've been a GP for 30 years. My question would be, when I was training to be a doctor and things, I used to think that I knew what a doctor was. You were, I suppose, our sort of figurehead doctor in Scotland. what do you think of what I've brought to this? Because, you know, in obstetrics, for instance, midwives are now doing things that obstetricians did, in all sorts of fields of medicine that other people are doing the job that the doctor did. So what is a doctor? What differentiates them from our other health colleagues?
In a couple of words. So we are senior decision makers. We are also the ones that are going to take the risky decisions. And we're the leaders.
Good evening. My name is Graham Dunnigan. I'm tempted with having the chief medical officer in front of me to tell you about my sore shoulder, but I would like to touch on a subject which probably 90% of the audience here tonight can relate to, and that is free prescriptions. And I would like to know your thoughts on the cost involved. It's been brought home to me recently when I discovered that a medication that my wife was on was actually costing £300 per month. And I had no idea that there was that kind of money involved in this drug. And I wonder what your views were. I know it touches on a bit of political side as well, free prescriptions, but I wonder what your views were on printing on prescriptions, what the cost of it is.
I've heard somebody mention money, and
it's
only got a few minutes left. So, first of all, let's be clear about the free prescriptions. When prescriptions weren't free, only 10% of the Scottish population paid for their prescriptions. Because only 10% of people met the criteria to need to pay them. So the difference in the budget between free and not free prescriptions is actually not very much. And in fact, you could argue that the administration of that 10%, of course, cuts into the savings. So that's one. Second thing, I asked really, I'm with you about the cost. So they talk in Wales about prudent healthcare. I didn't go down that line because they talk a lot about value-based care, and of course actually value is the outcome over the cost. They don't talk about cost. I don't really know why. Money's not a dirty word. This is reality, that the cost of your wife's prescription drugs were what they were. I am very happy that there's more transparency about that. I think that some of the issue is that people don't realise and it's not valued. I have thought about going into some of that in my first chief medical officer's report about what is true value, what does that mean. I decided I wanted to remain the chief medical officer of one. So I didn't, but I absolutely agree with you that why are we not more transparent about that? I think it would make people think a lot harder about what they're taking it for, and in fact, actually, back to do they really need it?
Hello, I'm Trisha Ford, and I'd like, if we could, to go back to a question that was asked down at the front about what we could call the obesity epidemic. And I understand your answer about the food industry, but we have an alcohol epidemic, and we're doing something about it. People don't get served in pubs if they're drunk. There are programs. There's similar things with tobacco. And yet, overeating, obesity, is causing illness. So, what is seriously being done about it?
So I think what we're doing is really realising the multifaceted way we need to tackle it. So far greater understanding of what is driving the obesity crisis, that already alluded to the obesogenic environment. The other aspect, of course, is people are taking excess physical activity and aren't doing physical jobs. So there is genuinely a multi-layered cross-government look at this. We genuinely have difficulty because there are conflicting people who don't agree with who've got Scotland's food larger as being one of the big promotions about Scotland's food, aren't they? So we know that where some of these are, we also know we're not alone. Across the world, this is a problem. Scotland is not unique in having a problem and not unique in not being able to solve it quickly. I think it's going to take a lot of different aspects. The sugar tax is totemic. That isn't going to make people lose weight particularly, but what I think that does is it gives that feeling of this being a bad thing, so they're going to tax it. A little bit like what you're talking about, tobacco, etc. So we've started on that journey. We're learning from how the success of the tobacco industry, which has been extremely successful, have been. I think that what we also need to realise that our environment needs to change. We need to have people making it easier to walk and cycle and safer. So there are all aspects. It's outside health, really, isn't it? So it's housing, it's the way we make our towns and cities. It's the food industry, it's what we teach our children in schools. I spoke to the people who do the school meals across Scotland. So I spoke to their assistant, or I spoke to their colleagues, and I gave them the chapter in Brussels about childhood obesity in Scotland. The obesity rate in children in Scotland, by the way, is falling. But the obesity rate in Scotland in children is falling because the wealthier children are less obese. The obesity rate in our most deprived communities is actually going up. So I showed them my graphs, and they thought this was interesting. They seemed to know about the maths. What I also talked to them about, though, was this complaint that they put to me, which was that they only had £1.38 to spend on a child's lunch. And I said, yes, but my son was at school on Friday, and he got pizza and chips for his lunch. Maybe we could drop the chips. And that might save some of your £1.38. So there's education of all sorts of people. It's not just educating the children that are eating the food.
Yes.
Thanks, your talk, Dr. Hollywood, my name is Colin Miller. Realistic medicine, it seems to be a discussion between people, doctors, people, and patients, people, all people. And they need a structure in which to do that. And what I was wondering was, where do you think there's a place for putting this into education at an early stage? Because if you get people to understand how to think about things, then they are better able to make realistic decisions about realistic medicine.
And I have an appointment with Steve Jobs
next year. Yes, from authority. Two last questions, please.
Dr. Goldwood, it's Lindsay Stewart here. I wanted to touch on a previous question, which is my question is, does the National Health Service create the situation where people don't take care of their own health? I mean, it's quite complex, as we've talked just about diet and stuff.
This is self-management week, and you have plants in the audience. It is self-management week. So absolutely, a lot of literature about that. I think, again, I talk in my report about the doctor knows best culture, so I'm afraid that I think that we've, to some extent, created some of this. And in fact, back to the empowering people, people are the ones who know their illnesses more than anyone. And in fact, the self-management is something that people then really very much welcome. So there's a lot of literature, not on Twitter at the moment, that would answer. You know, if we have more time, I would talk to you more about that. But I think that's certainly a very, along with social prescribing, as it's usually called, is definitely fits with what I'm talking about.
Yes, well, my name's doing part of an expert, so I'm finally up in here with you. So, a few minutes ago, I'm now a benefits advisor. But what I was going to ask was, when I first started the pharmacy 40 years ago, there was a lot of talk about patient compliance. the time I finished years ago was all about patient concordance, so there obviously was some progress. But the other bus phase it was about, of course, then was evidence-based medicine. I just wonder, say a wee bit about what evidence you have, perhaps in other countries, that the realistic medicine approach actually improves people's outcomes.
So, again, I think we're at the start of this. So, the other countries in the world that I'm aware of that are here, medical, Wales, and Scottish healthcare. Is choosing wisely in Canada and slowness in Italy. So, so I think that this has come along at a time when people are discussing exactly this way of talking differently, of practicing differently. I don't think we're at the stage of knowing if that starts to improve our outcomes yet.
Dr. Colby, it was a terrific talk, thank you very much. I'm thinking of your illustrious predecessor, Harry Burns, who bust a gut to try and address the terrible deprivation in Scotland. He believed that deprivation was the cause of so much of our terrible history of ill health in this country. Are you minded to follow his example and concentrate your efforts on that section of the population which is causing, which is costing us so dear?
You believe that the deprived part of the population is costing us so dear. If in fact we look at who survives the longest, and therefore costs the NHS the most.
Well, thank you very much for your excellent questions. now, it's possible that to give a vote of thanks to your colleagues. Discussion about medicine as an art, including the refiltering of Dr. Google by GPs to try and make a decision, and also about the use of time by GPs. And it leads me to wonder if, like Marx, we have overlooked the fact that our profession is a craft. And she also described that some of the elements of our approach are arm on you, but it certainly is a brilliant new package with an excellent title. And of course, from your position of power and authority, we are very lucky to have her proposing those views. I myself moved from being an NHS provider, and I was a GP, to a service user, and I'm more confident that NHS Scotland is on the right track. If Carlsberg did the NHS, then NHS Scotland is probably how they would do it. So, thank you very much. And we have now had the regular number of applause spontaneously. Please applaud again. Thank you.
Scott, yeah.